This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with John Barry, the celebrated writer who composed Rising Tide in 1997, named by one poll as one of the 50 greatest books of all time. John Barry is now a public official, vice president of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, and he and his group have taken the initiative and filed a major lawsuit against the oil and gas industry. John Barry will talk about the suit that has drawn fire from Governor Bobby Jindal. Also, Tony Thompson, a true crime writer from Great Britain, with a compelling book about motorcycle gangs, outlaws, one man's rise through the savage world of renegade bikers, Hell's Angels, and global crime. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. Please call 877-217-5757, toll free. And we do want to note that as we start today's show, not only will funeral services be held in New Orleans today for Lindy Boggs, the congresswoman from Louisiana and the wife of the late, great Hale Boggs. Lindy died over the weekend at the age of 97, but today also marks the first day of life for Eli Wallace Edwards, son of Edwin Washington Edwards and Trina Edwards. Born this morning, 6 pounds 3 ounces, Eli Wallace Edwards, August 1st, 2013, 6 days before his dad turns 86. And with us to talk about some other matters is John Barry, the celebrated writer who's written one of the quintessential books about Louisiana and the Great Flood of 1927, Rising Tide, and is still active in his state as a member of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. He is the vice president of that group, and in its wisdom, the group has filed suit, and we are here to talk with him about a lawsuit that has drawn the ire of none other than Governor Bobby Jindal. Good morning, John Barry.
Good morning.
John, why is the suit?
Well, let me first say something about Lindy Boggs. I did know her. She was really an extraordinary person and extraordinarily nice and very smart. Everyone in Congress on both sides of the aisle loved her, and she managed to use being nice as a political club, oddly enough. She got a lot done for the state and for the country, a loss. But back to your subject.
Well, yeah, a suit against nearly 100 energy companies, accusing these companies of devastating Louisiana's coast, increasing the risk of damage during a hurricane. The suit has drawn fire from Governor Bobby Jindal, who says it should be dropped. Why do you think it's necessary?
Well, I mean, it's very simple. We, or the state at large, do not have the money to protect people's lives and property. And the oil industry, without any question whatsoever, every scientific report says this, and the industry itself concedes it, that they are a major contributor to the destruction of the buffer of not just marsh and wetlands, but in some cases what was once solid ground that was outside the levees, and that used to protect people from storm surge. That's largely gone, and more is on the way to disappear. And we don't want, or we're not asking, we'd love it if they did, we're not asking them to fix everything. We just want them to repair the part of the destruction which they caused, and which they agreed in writing, because most of this work was done under permits. Those permits, almost all of them, explicitly require them to repair the damage that they did, and they have not done that. And then there's another legal principle, which is unique to Louisiana, in America anyway, but it actually goes back to the Romans, and it's a well-established concept in civil law. It's called servitude of drain. You cannot do something on your property which sends more water onto someone else's property. and well-established in case law, including in the context of flood protection in Louisiana. By destroying this buffer protecting the population from hurricanes, they are sending more water against the levees. So we would like them to stop doing that, and that requires them to fix what they broke. Again, mm-hmm. we don't hold them responsible for everything, but they are responsible for part of the problem, and they really need to fix a part of the problem that they broke, which means they need to obey the law, and they need to keep their written word, do what they agreed to do when those permits were issued.
Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association President Chris John, the former congressman from Crowley, whose members are included in the suit, says it unfairly singles out the oil industry for activities that have been encouraged by both the state and federal governments and will contribute to a climate that could scare away businesses from Louisiana. And Governor Jindal says we're not going to allow a single levy board that's been hijacked by a group of trial lawyers to determine flood protection, coastal restoration, and economic repercussions for the entire state.
You notice none of the attacks on us ever mention flood protection, which is what we're about. Our board was created after Katrina. It was designed to be insulated from political pressure. We have expertise on the board of scientists. We have coastal scientists. We have numerous engineers. We have meteorologists. We have a member from North Carolina who co-authored the most sophisticated model for storm surge, which is used around the world. We have a member from California who is the head of the floodplain management for the state of California. This is a board of experts, and we believed in our collective scientific and policy judgment that the only way to protect the public from storms going forward was to get money to improve the system. Our system is not good enough. And the only place you can, I mean, it makes sense if someone promised in writing to repair damage and they haven't done it, then we are asking them to do what they promised to do. Ultimately, the suit comes down to something that simple. The idea that it's anti-business to ask a business to keep its written word seems a little odd to me. The idea that the industry will leave Louisiana is absurd. First, they'll go when the oil and gas goes. As long as that's here, they're not going anywhere. Second, if you start actually doing coastal restoration, you are going to increase the jobs. I mean, there'll be an enormous amount of jobs generated by doing all this work that we hope gets done.
John Barry, that's the voice we're hearing, his 1997 book, Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and How It Changed America, appeared on the New York Times bestseller list, and it was named in 2005 by the New York Public Library as one of the 50 best books of all kinds. John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air with John Barry. Good morning, John.
Yes, Mr. Barry. I enjoyed the book on the flood of 27. My mother was involved in that. She was a victim of it. My question is this. What about the federal government? As I understand it, in the early days during World War II of drilling in the marsh, the War Department also had to give a permit for the drilling. If that's so, why isn't the government also a defendant?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, we don't hold the industry responsible for everything. There are multiple causes. The fact is, suing the Corps of Engineers, it's just not productive. As they demonstrated in the Mr. Go lawsuit, they've got immunity from this stuff. Whereas the oil industry does not have immunity, and they explicitly promised to do what we're asking them to do now. So they just seem, I mean, it seems like impossible to get the government, but I would say that what they've done, they do share some responsibility, but you know, that's somewhat of a side issue.
Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority Chair Garrett Graves says he and others will talk to board members in hopes of convincing them that this lawsuit will conflict with other efforts by the state. Have you heard from Mr. Graves or anyone with the state government?
Well, of course, after he wrote us a letter a few days ago, I guess the evening of the lawsuit, we replied and we invited him to our next meeting, which is August 15th at the Orleans Levy District, and I assume he's coming. We're very eager to hear from him. Let me go back to one point about the government's comment that we were hijacked by lawyers. Nothing could be further from the truth. I went around looking for lawyers. First, I tried, the board wanted to do this. I tried to find someone who would do it on a pro bono basis. Couldn't. Went through some academics who were experts in environmental litigation. Talked to another litigator who probably didn't have the resources. I think he was a fine lawyer. And anyway, I asked for names of people who might have the resources. This is going to cost the lawyers millions of dollars. We don't pay a penny of it unless we win. If we lose, there is no cost to us. So anyway, I asked for recommendations. I was given several names by really one of the national leaders in environmental litigation, and I called the first name on the list, and that was Gladstone Jones. And he was very interested. I would say he has beaten Exxon for about $100 million, close to that. He's very experienced. We have another, there's three law firms involved. Another is beaten Shell for almost as much money. So these are attorneys that the industry has got to take very seriously.
Well, Garrett Graves says even if you're successful in extracting billions from the oil industry, it won't go far because it costs $2 billion a year to keep the coast from deteriorating. Does he have a point?
Well, that's statewide. And what's the alternative? If you have zero, that doesn't help keep the state from deteriorating either. We only have legal standing for our jurisdiction, which is the east bank of the Mississippi River in the New Orleans metropolitan area. And a little bit in St. Tammany and Tangipahoa. I think if there's actually significantly more damage caused by the oil and gas industry and pipelines out to our west, and if we had entities to our west joining in, then the numbers would go way up. And what I would really like to see would be a statewide solution. I don't want to spend the next 10 years in court. I would really rather have a political statewide solution, but that certainly includes the oil industry, which has already conceded it's the fact that they have done damage. I would simply like them to pay for the part of the problem they caused. They are all for restoration. They participated in the state master plan. They know that without coastal restoration, their infrastructure is at risk. Their business is at risk. They simply want taxpayers to pay for it. The wealthiest industry in the world wants the taxpayer to pay for it. I would think Governor Romney would term them takers.
John Barry is the voice we're hearing, the celebrated writer, who also is an activist of sort and is a member of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. That group has filed suit against about 100 energy companies. And Governor,
I would say I would not describe myself as an activist. I have a responsibility, a fiduciary responsibility, as a member of the Flood Protection Authority. Our job, which we take very seriously, is to protect people's lives and property. I have not been involved in environmental activism at all in my entire life. I think I probably was a member of the Sierra Club at one point, but that membership lapsed. They keep sending me reminders.
All right, we'll talk more. Governor Jindal says as the suit plays out, There certainly could be some legislation filed in the next session. We'll talk about it with John Berry. 297-5633, your number, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. A major lawsuit filed against the oil and gas industry by the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. John Berry is with us, the writer who's vice president of this group. He wrote in an op-ed piece, "If nothing is done, the State Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority estimates that statewide flood damages will rise to an average of a staggering $23.4 billion a year. For the wealthiest industry in the world, to shift the burden of preventing those costs to the citizens of Louisiana is unfair, to say the least. The way forward is to make partners of the responsible parties, precisely as the law requires, and to ensure that those who have contributed to the problem now contribute to the solution." A few weeks ago, we heard from Public Service Commissioner Foster Campbell before this suit was filed, and of course he has been a longtime advocate of turning to the energy industry to alleviate the problems with coastal restoration. Kevin, can we hear from Foster Campbell and his comments regarding this kind of action that the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East is doing?
We know, positively know, that oil companies' offshore activity caused a lot of erosion in the state of Louisiana. But do we ask them to pay for it? Would Mr. Jindal ask Exxon or Chevron or Shell to pay for any of the erosion? Absolutely not.
Now, that's Foster Campbell, John Berry. But his sentiments, they were in sync with yours. They're not matched by Senator Mary Landrieu, his fellow Democrat, who is a big proponent of the oil and gas industry. She has given indication that she's not really particularly happy about this suit, and certainly David Vitter is echoing what the governor is saying. You have some strong opponents when it comes to this.
Well, I'm not sure you're correct on Senator Landrieu's position. She issued a statement that we need to fight for coastal restoration everywhere, including in the courts. So if she said anything against the suit, then that's brand new in the last hours, and I don't know of it.
Well, she said we need legislation.
Well, that's hardly. I support the legislation. She is, in fact, issued a statement. Hearing. I mean, these are separate issues. She wants, I'm sure you've talked about, the FAIR Act to give us a larger share of offshore revenue.
That's the legislation.
I am absolutely, completely in support of that law. But all that does is the oil industry is already paying taxes to the federal government. All that does is change the split between how much goes to the federal government and how much goes to the Gulf Coast. That has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that the industry has destroyed part of the coastal lands, and that they have an obligation legally, and they agreed to it, to fix that. I totally support the FAIR Act, Senator Landrieu's Act, and as I say, these are not mutually exclusive whatsoever.
No. Here's her quote. She says, "We need justice for the coast, our people and our communities. Some of our local officials believe this suit has merit, and time will tell." Now, I would think that if she were in favor of the suit, she would come out and say it rather than saying some of our local officials believe this suit has merit.
Well, she has another statement in which, I mean, Senator Landrieu is certainly capable of speaking for herself. But there's another statement in which she said that we need to fight everywhere, including in the courts.
All right. 297-5633. John Berry with us. He has drawn opposition from Governor Jindal, no doubt about that. His fellow Brown University graduate, by the way. You and the governor not seeing eye to eye, even though you share an alma mater.
No, we did meet actually at a Brown alumni function before he ever ran for any office, and we used to communicate prior to his becoming governor. I occasionally would see him. And once after Katrina, we had a very long, probably a two-hour heart-to-heart talk about things down here.
How did that go?
Well, I'll talk about that some other time.
All right. You're native of Providence, Rhode Island, aren't you?
Yes, but my ties to Louisiana go way back, 40 years ago.
I know that.
I was I always bring it up. I was a coach on the Tulane team that beat an LSU team that went to the Orange Bowl. We beat them 14-0. Their only other loss that year was the number one Alabama, and Tulane had a great team, probably its best since 1948.
And the date was December 1st, 1973. Largest crowd in the history of the South to see a football game at that time. Watched it at Old Tulane Stadium. The last time the Tigers and Greenies played there. John Berry, you must have been in your early 20s at that time. How were you on the staff of Benny Ellender?
Well, that's a long story, too, kind of off the subject.
Well, Kevin Gallagher, in his wisdom and abilities, he has found the voice of John Ferguson on that night, the voice of the Tigers. And John Ferguson, he was always willing to give the opponent its due when they kicked the Tigers you-know-what. And here's how John sounded when Tulane beat LSU 14-0 before, 86,000? How many fans?
958.
86,900.
However, there were at least 500,000 who claimed to have been there, probably more than that.
Well, the great John Ferguson described it this way.
Tulane ahead, 7-0, and in prospect of making it 4 points. Tight line.
That's not the end of the game, Kevin. I think the end comes at 3:35. But anyway, we get the point. We'll go back to the lawsuit. Lynn and Melrose. Lynn, good morning. You're on with John Berry.
Good morning, Jim, my friend John. Congratulations for this effort. I think you deserve tremendous appreciation by the Louisianans in general. You've already talked about it, but one of the dirty secrets, it seems to me, the whole issue is the funding issue and the fact that even if everything were to go our way, which it won't, in the absence of this suit, there is no, other than the Deepwater Horizon fines, which are on the horizon, we don't know how much money will be there. There wouldn't be enough money to fix what you're talking about, and every effort, including yours, is critical. And to tell the public that, oh, we've got federal money coming, when we've got a governor who sticks his finger in the president's eye every chance he gets, it just amazes me that we can keep fooling the public into thinking there's help on the way when there really isn't. Anyway, that's all. I just congratulate you again.
Thank you.
All right.
That's exactly the problem. I sit on the CPRA, and I can recall shortly before the spill, we were looking at the out years and the projects we were hoping to start rising into the billions, and the money that we had coming in actually was dropping into below $100 million, as I recall. So there was this huge gap. The BP is certainly going to give us a significant amount of money. It's going to be enough probably to start most of the projects that are ready to start. But it is not going to be enough to finish those projects. It is not going to be enough to take care of the coast. We absolutely need every possible funding stream, and it makes perfect sense, again, to ask the industry to keep its written word, do what it agreed to do in writing, and also obey the law. And it's the wealthiest industry in the world. You're telling me they should not be held to their contractual obligations and that they should not have to obey the law? No one has attacked the substance of this lawsuit.
Jared at LSU. Jared, you're on the air with John Berry. Hi, Jared.
Hey, guys. Hey, John, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the master plan, how much restoration the plan could account for if totally funded compared to your lawsuit that you're bringing. And I can take my answer off the air.
Well, the plan is scale down to $50 billion basically over the next 50 years. That's, of course, statewide. I believe in our jurisdiction it's about $9 billion. We would certainly not get that much money from the industry even if we won. But as the previous caller, whom I know, Len Barr, who was a coastal advisor to five governors and was Mike Foster's chief coastal advisor, you know, as he said, we need all funding streams that we could possibly get. And if there were some kind of statewide solution, then you've got a huge leg up and some chance of protecting the people in the entire state, not just those in the New Orleans metro area.
Ellen in South Downs. Good morning, Ellen. You're on the air with John Barry. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Mr. Inkster and Mr. Barry. Thanks for taking my call. My question is more about the permitting process. And Mr. Barry, you discussed kind of the clause that states that they have to fix what they've done. And I guess if you wouldn't mind giving a few more details about that, I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I wish I could give you a little bit more details. That's more of a legal question, which I'm trying to stay away from. As the permitting process has changed over a number of decades, and the language got more and more and more explicit in terms of what the responsibility to repair the damage was. And the industry voluntarily agreed to all that. I mean, there's not that much more that can be said. Now, it's true that it wasn't enforced. Some of that's the state's responsibility, and some of that's the federal government's responsibility. But the damage is ongoing, and in fact, increasing. So I don't believe that lets them off the hook. And I think it's something really that should be in the courts, and the courts will decide.
Well, about 2,000 square miles of coastal wetlands have been lost in the last 100 years in Louisiana, and that, of course, it makes it easier for hurricanes to travel across land and cause great damage to the masses, as some in recent vintage have done. Now, how much of the problem is related, in your judgment, John, to the oil and gas industry?
Well, it varies from place to place, and specifically in our area, one of the reasons this suit is going to cost millions of dollars is not simply for the lawyer's time, but to fund the scientific research to define precisely how much. In some areas, oil and gas activity is a very small factor. In other areas, it is a huge factor. For example, people talk about the levees being a problem, and they are a problem because by preventing floods, then there's no replenishment of the land from sediment from the overflow of the river. But the Mississippi River would not flood Lake Charles. If there were no levees whatsoever, that water is never going to get to Lake Charles. When you get to the western part of the state, the levees have absolutely no impact, and you still have a lot of land loss in that area, and that, without actually doing the research, it's hard for me to categorically say, but my guess would be the land loss out west is almost entirely from oil and gas.
Do you think your suit will meet constitutional muster?
Well, I think it clearly meets constitutional muster. You know, the governor talked about hijacking the lawyers, which, is, as I said earlier, I think it's just not correct. The idea originated with the board. I went around trying to find lawyers who would do it pro bono, but the resources required were enormous, and they couldn't do it. And we, as a levy board, we couldn't afford it. Before we ever approached a lawyer outside, our counsel said we had the authority. Separately, the Attorney General's office said we had the authority. The lawyer themselves since they were putting an enormous amount of money, cash out of pocket, as well as all their, you know, thousands of hours of their time at risk, researched the question before they took the case, and they felt we had, very confident we had the authority, and then the Attorney General's office approved the contract, so the Attorney General is formally and officially ruled that we have the authority. I think that is crystal clear, and I think we would welcome a challenge to our authority to file the lawsuit.
Well, it will be fascinating to see how this plays out, and the implications are dramatic. What is your assessment, John Barry, of the America's Wetlands, the group that is along the same lines as you as far as trying to find ways to curb coastal restoration, restoration?
I think America's Wetlands has done a lot of good. I will note that their funding comes from Shell, Chevron. I believe they have API listed, which I think is the American Petroleum Institute. And all they ever talk about is levies, levies, levies. The levies, as I said earlier, are a factor. There's no question about it. But they're not the only factor. Without question, just as certain as we are that the levies are a factor, so is the oil and gas exploration and production. And the navigation industry is a factor. The Gulf Intracoastal Waterway is a factor. Mr. Go is a factor. The jetties that carry sediment 2.5 miles out into the Gulf of Mexico and drop it into deep water are a factor. And so is the oil industry a factor. And we don't expect them to fix everything. We just expect them to fix the part of the problem that they created. That's it. And which they are legally obligated to fix, and which they agreed in writing to fix.
297-5633 is your number, and we will continue for a bit longer with John Barry. And coming next, fascinating writer Tony Thompson. But John Barry is now, I said an activist, and that probably wasn't the right term. He's a public official of sorts, and this group that you're involved with, which is a substantial organization, the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East, has filed suit. Were you the ringleader? Whose idea was this?
Well, I chair the legal committee, so I did take the lead on this action.
All right. Pastor Randy and Zachary, good morning. You're on with John Barry.
I have a two-part question. The part is, first part is that the fact that Governor Jindal came out and made a statement like this, do you find that encouraging that there is merit to this lawsuit? And the second part of the question is, could you please tell us what will happen to the coast if nothing is done? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, well, did you go already?
Yeah.
Because I didn't quite hear the first part of the question. Let me answer the second part. The second part is, coastal land loss is going to continue, and we're going to be in deep trouble. And we need money to fix it. And that is the purpose of the lawsuit.
And we shall return after this brief pause. Still time to talk with John Barry if you wish. 297-5633, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And John Barry has been good enough to spend much of the hour with us talking about a lawsuit filed last week with the ink barely dry on this massive litigation involving about 100 energy companies. Governor Bobby Jindal blasted the suit. He says the levy board has overstepped its authority. He's called for the commissioners to drop the case. And my guess is that, John Barry, that's not going to happen.
We are willing to listen. And if someone convinces us that it's in the best interest of flood protection to drop the case, then we would drop it. But we thought about this for months. We've been discussing this since January. We didn't file it till July 24th. And looking at all the, you know, turning it upside down, and we just did not see any other way to protect the public. But if someone demonstrates to us that that the best interest of protecting people's lives and property is to drop the lawsuit, we'll do it. So far, no one has come forward with any reason. This really is a simple choice. It comes down to protecting the oil industry, the wealthiest industry in the world, from protecting them from having to keep the agreements they've made, their written word, and also to obey the law. Or you can protect the public from hurricanes. It's really that simple. And I've been a little bit surprised at the pushback. And none of the pushback has criticized the substance of the lawsuit. They're all saying, well, you're overstepping your authority. Well, no one else has done it. This problem has been going on for decades. And Foster Campbell's tried to do it. But, basically nobody in Louisiana has done it. And the reason is politics. And we are insulated from politics. And that's probably why we are capable of doing it. We're a board primary. I'm actually the least scientific member of the board, probably with the least technical knowledge, and yet even I have worked, been invited to the National Academy of Sciences to work on these issues.
Michael, downtown. Michael, please be brief. You're on the air with John Barry.
Yeah, real quick, John, I love your book, Rising Tide, and I just want to thank you for all the people in Louisiana for what you're doing. This is a solution, whether everybody gets on board or not, the other levy districts, the other parishes, that needs to happen. I was on council in the 1990s, and we tried to do something similar to this, and you're doing great work. Don't be pressured. Don't let the governor push on you. He works for the oil companies, and you don't. And you're doing great.
All right. Will this invite similar suits?
I hope so. Frankly, I think, as I said, if we get some more plaintiffs, some other entities like ourselves with our responsibilities, then I think the pressure on the companies will mount. And I think if we make progress in the courts, as soon as we get any wins at all, I think other entities are going to have to, because the potential for protecting the public, there's no other source of income to fix the coast.
Lee and Bro Bridge. Lee, you're on the air. Please be brief. You're talking to John Barry.
Yes. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, John. I just want to say thank you so much for having the kahunas to file a suit like this. I think it's about time. And a quick question. Do you have a plan for an option just in case the opponents try to go through the legislature? And do you have a plan?
Well, we recognize that is certainly a line of attack, and we are preparing for it. We are a non-political board, but that doesn't mean we're stupid or don't have any understanding of politics. So hopefully we would fight off efforts to derail the action.
Well, John, it's always nice to talk with you, and hopefully we will do so again soon. And come December 1st, it'll be 40 years since Tulane beat LSU 14-0.
Well, I'm undefeated against them. That's all I can say.
All right,
okay, thanks a lot, Jim.
It's always a
pleasure being on.
Best of luck. Thanks. Bye-bye. We're joined now by Tony Thompson, widely regarded as one of Britain's top true crime writers, and he has written a compelling book about an outlaw motorcycle club, a band of brothers like no other. As a member of the small-town biker group known as the Pagans, Daniel Snake Dog Boone had a ringside seat to some of those violent biker battles ever fought. And when he first joined in the early 1980s, Boone could never have imagined that this ragtag club would one day grow to become a part of the Outlaws, a major gang that would challenge the Hells Angels for supremacy in a battle that raged around the globe for decades. Four decades. Now, Tony Thompson, how does a motorcycle group end up having a worldwide impact?
Well, motorcycle gangs started in the aftermath of the Second World War, mainly with people who wanted to recapture that sense of adrenaline and excitement that had been going on during combat. And they started off as social groups, and then they just started to expand. And one of the first ones to expand was the Hells Angels, who came to London in 1969 and started up a chapter there. And since then, the groups have expanded to be in dozens of countries all around the world with thousands of members.
Three continents. How does this happen?
I think it's just a question of the gangs wanting to get bigger and bigger, and when they started running out of people to recruit in their own countries, they looked abroad and started to recruit there. I think it was also a question of people in the UK and elsewhere looking at these clubs and saying, we want to be part of that. So, you know, what would often happen was people from the UK would come to America and ask how they could join, how they could start up a branch of that club themselves. So whenever you see these clubs in any country in the world, they're always completely affiliated and authorized. It's never a question of just starting one up on your own. You have to actually go through the right channels. So it is one enormous organization that spreads around the world.
There's a code of silence with these groups. How did you crack that code?
Well, I was very lucky in that I got a senior member of the club actually approached me to ask me to write the book. He was very concerned about what was going on with the club that he joined, in that it started off being very much a social thing and ended up being... he ended up getting involved in acts of brutality, and some of his friends actually got involved in murder. And he was disturbed by that so much that he felt that it was important for the public to actually have a better understanding of what goes on within these clubs. And that's why he approached me and asked me to work on the book with him.
Publishers Weekly says of The Outlaws by Tony Thompson, colorful and gripping, his account of Boone and his sinister outlaw world turns most previous biker chronicles upside down, plunging the reader into a harrowing universe full of cruelty, bloodletting, and deadly consequences. How do these guys live?
Well, for the most part, it's about sort of partying and socializing and just hanging out together. The problems come when a rival club tries to start up in their area or tries to take over territory they consider to be their own. And that descends very quickly into acts of brutality and violence, and often murder, or sometimes even multiple murder. But for the most part, the lifestyle is based around, I would say, partying and socializing, and the criminality comes in on the side of that rather than being central to it.
And why is murder necessary for these groups?
Well, I think it's just an escalation. If you the book actually starts with an attack by the club that Boone belongs to on a rival club, and then they attack back, and it escalates there, and it ends up with someone being killed. I think it is just a question of the same way that global conflicts escalate, that you do something that you think is going to be a retaliation. You think it's perhaps in proportion, and the other side decide to do something even more vicious in order to try and deter you from doing anything else in retaliation to that.
What kinds of backgrounds do these people who are involved in these groups usually have?
I think it's surprisingly wide. I think it's very easy to see these as a very specific element of society, but the people I spoke to and the people I found out about had a wide range of backgrounds. Some of them were, as you might expect, motorbike mechanics and manual workers. Others were members of local government councils, worked in the theatre, worked as electricians, pilots, all sorts of things. Pretty much every job that you can imagine, there's someone who does that who is a member of one of these clubs.
Usually white guys?
Mostly white guys. There are some specific clubs that are aimed at different ethnic minorities, but the Hells Angels are fairly notorious for being pretty exclusive when it comes to only having mostly white members, and other clubs are often the same. But as I say, there are, well, whatever ethnicity you are, you can normally find a club that will be specifically aimed at that group.
Tony Thompson, the well-known writer in Great Britain, regarded as his country's top true crime writer, and his book is Outlaws, One Man's Rise Through the Savage World of Renegade Bikers, Hell's Angels, and Global Crime. I don't imagine you just showed up with a microphone and a notepad and started getting these people to talk. I would think this was an endeavor that took some time.
Yeah, it was a couple of years worth of research and lots of meetings with people who then would tell me that they would have to deny ever having spoken to me or told me anything. Lots of time spent in courtrooms and meeting with police officers, both covert and uncovert, and lots of times going through records and newspapers to piece the story together and corroborate what I was being told.
How prominent are these groups right now in the United States?
Well, they're slightly on the decline in terms of numbers in the United States, but they're growing globally. But having said that, shows such as Sons of Anarchy and The Devil's Ride are extremely popular on television over there at the moment, and that's raising the profile of the groups as a whole and actually bringing new members in who find what they see on those shows to be appealing.
Tattoos usually are an accompaniment of these gentlemen, I would think.
Yeah, very much, and they normally have quite specific meanings. I think part of joining any of these clubs is that you have to show you're committed to the club for life. So having a tattoo is a way of showing that it's always going to be there with you, because these tattoos tend to be very large and not the kind of things that can be easily removed. And also you can have additional pieces added onto your tattoo to show things that you might have been involved in, either acts of criminality or various acts of depravity, perhaps. And it's a way of recording those things on you permanently.
Are you a biker, Tony?
I do ride a bike. I'm not a member of a club, but yes, I do. I do ride a bike just socially, as it were.
Are there some clubs that are peace-loving and not involved in sex and violence and all kinds of bad things?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. In fact, the members of these particular clubs call themselves one percenters because they basically claim that they represent only 1%. Basically, 99% of all bikers are law-abiding, peace-loving, happy-go-lucky people, and these guys specifically say they are the 1% who are outside of that, who are not like the others, who are outlaws.
Now, amid the violence, there are some funny stories, aren't there?
Yeah, there is a huge amount of humor. I mean, sometimes it's kind of gallows humor, the kind that you get perhaps in war and that kind of thing. But it's but there are some hilarious stories. I mean, there was one guy who was arrested by the police while he was wearing a disguise of a long wig, and he thought the police knew who he was when they took him back to the station and started questioning him. But it turned out that she didn't recognize him at all and spent the whole interview asking if they knew this particular person being him. And he actually ended up walking out of there, and I understand quite a few heads rolled when the police realized they had the person they wanted and had let him go.
Well, what happens to Daniel Snake Dog Boone?
Well, he's living a bit of a quiet life now. He's come away from the club having been disillusioned with what was going on. And having told me the stories that he did, and having broken the code of silence that he initially took within the gang, his life is to a degree in danger. So he's making sure that he sort of lives as quiet a life as he can and stays away from those biker circles to ensure that he doesn't end up having to pay the consequences of his actions.
Now, you describe drive-by shootings.
Yes, there have been several drive-by shootings. I mean, when these gangs go to war with one another, it's pretty much no holds barred. There have been car bombings, drive-by shootings, incidents of mass murder, certainly stabbings, beatings, pretty much everything that you could imagine. It's quite medieval at times, and the weapons range from blunt objects to high-powered military-type weapons. And certainly in Europe, there have been cases of people using grenade launchers and military-style firearms to attack one another.
Airport ambushes?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. In fact, Daniel himself was involved in one of those when he traveled to Europe to meet with a group of bikers, and as they arrived at the airport and came out, they found themselves under attack by a rival gang who were armed with assault rifles.
And you're talking on some occasions of brutal hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. There were many, many occasions that, that Daniel recounted to me where he would find himself in a field or at a festival with a group of his fellow bikers, and some rivals would turn up, and it would end up almost like a scene from Braveheart or something, with these two groups running at each other across a field and kicking seven bells out of each other. So yes, I mean, I think sometimes it did become like something out of a medieval scene.
What did you think of Easy Rider?
Well, I think that's kind of the sort of the idea of the film that got a lot of people into biking, but it doesn't sort of show the level of brutality that's the reality. I think that's more of a kind of ideal picture of how the way that people would like biking to be, but it unfortunately isn't always like that for the people involved.
Filmed in Louisiana, by the way.
Of course, yes.
Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson. There were other movies, though, that you note in your book, including The Wild One. That was, what, 60 years ago with Marlon Brando?
That's right. I mean, that was the one that really sort of was the first attempt by Hollywood to actually capture a little bit of what was going on in reality. But certainly during the 60s, there was a whole spate of films by some quite prominent directors all about bikers, and often starring members of real biker gangs. Sonny Barger and several members of the Hells Angels actually earned quite good sums of money for appearing as extras in these films to add an air of authenticity. And I think at that time, there was a great fascination, and I think there still is, but there was a really huge fascination with bikers, and there wasn't the level of association with fear or criminality that there is now. That really changed at the end of the 70s when they were involved in some sex scandals, and also the incident at, with the Rolling Stones concert where they were doing security and a guy was murdered, kind of started changing public attitudes towards them.
And both Peter Fonda and Jack Nicholson were in biker movies before their one that we know best. You note that Fonda was in The Wild Angels in 1966 and Jack Nicholson in Hell's Angels on Wheels. And that was long before, or at least a few years before, Easy Rider.
That's right. And I think the bikers really appreciated the chance to raise their own public profile and to hang around with these stars and party with them. And I think it also lent an air of credibility to the actors themselves.
The book is Outlaws, One Man's Rise Through the Savage World of Renegade Bikers, Hell's Angels, and Global Crime, Mr. Tony Thompson. Thank you, Tony. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.